But you can still write to us at Destinies, care of the Science Fiction Forum, Post Office Box 461, Stony Brook, New York, 11790. That's Destinies, care of the Science Fiction Forum, Post Office Box 461, Stony Brook, New York, 11790. Next week, we'll have some science fiction short stories for the Christmas season. Until then, this is Howard Mark Olin,
John Madonia,
and Ralph Schiano,
wishing you a happy Hanukkah and inviting you to join us every Tuesday at 11:30 p.m., and we'll meet our destinies together.
Good evening and welcome to Destinies. I'm Howard Margolin, and tonight the voice of science fiction brings you an all Star Trek edition of Colleen Bemmett's Nerd Alert News and some poetry from Star Trek The Next Generation, read by Rory Kelly. We'll also salute the release of the latest remake of Dune by opening the Destinies archives for an encore of Dune Part 1, Battle for the Known Universe, as part of a Destinies Radio Theater double feature. Our other audio drama tonight is presented in celebration of the upcoming 50th anniversary of The Electric Company, which made its PBS debut on October 25, 1971. Later, we'll hear The Last Laugh, Spidey Meets the Jester, written by Pat Thackeray, from the Electric Company album Spidey Super Stories. But first, and throughout the show, we'll listen to songs written and, in most cases, performed by Tom Lehrer for the Electric Company, beginning with one that he did not sing on the program, but released on his 2000 box set, The Remains of Tom Lehrer, N'T.
Isn't it a lovely day?
No, it isn't.
Could you come outside and play?
No, I couldn't.
Did you ever take a hike?
No, I didn't.
Well, how'd you like to ride my bike?
Frankly, I wouldn't.
Isn't, couldn't, didn't, wouldn't. Is that all you can say?
Isn't, couldn't, didn't, wouldn't. Yes, now go away. The sweetest sound to me, it stands for not. I like it a lot. It's spelled N'T.
Have you ever tried to smile?
No, I haven't.
Won't you try it for a while?
No, I won't.
Are there games to play in there?
No, there aren't.
Then why do you like to stay in there?
Frankly, I don't.
Haven't, won't, aren't, don't. Is that all you can say?
Haven't, won't, aren't, don't. And I said, go away. Grouches all agree. We get a glow from saying no with N'T.
Do you talk to anyone?
No, I don't.
Come on out and have some fun.
No, I couldn't.
Can't you even tell me why?
No, I can't.
Will it kill you just to try?
Well, I shouldn't.
Don't, couldn't, can't, shouldn't. Now try it once my way. Do.
Do.
Could.
Could.
Can.
Can.
Should.
Should. Hey, that feels okay.
So come along with me.
I'll give it a try and say goodbye to N'T.
Spidey meets the jester in The Last Laugh. All is quiet at the Lincoln Savings Bank. Two guards are on duty at the big vault. Enter the jester.
My trick card will blow that safe wide open.
Hey, who's this clown?
You're not allowed down here, mister.
Let me entertain you. Pick a card, any card.
Gee, I'm crazy for card tricks.
You'll get a bang out of this.
The deck was loaded.
This money isn't funny. It's the real thing. Now to make my getaway.
A policeman on horseback passes by.
A horse? Just what I need. Evening, officer. Wanna buy a yo-yo?
Ha! What a lot! No thanks, boy. I'm too big for yo-yos.
But this one's different. Let me show you. No copper cramps my style.
The policeman is trapped by the yo-yo string.
That knocked him off his high horse.
Another dirty deed is done.
Home with the loot.
Across town at the Daily Bugle.
Dexter, city swept by one-man crime wave.
In the editor's office.
And just was pulled another bank job. He must be stopped.
Maybe Spider-Man can help, JJ.
That costume clod. I wouldn't let him sharpen my pencils.
JJ's not Spidey's greatest fan.
I'll offer a $24 reward for the capture of the Jester.
That's not much, Mr. Jameson. It would pay Aunt May's doctor bill.
There's one bank he hasn't hit.
The Semen Savings Bank.
Get over there fast, Parker, and get some pictures.
Outside, by himself.
So long, Peter Parker.
Hello, Spider-Man.
Spidey speeds to the scene.
My spider sense is talking.
Suddenly, Spider-Man spots...
The Jester. The jig is up, Jester.
Who said that?
I'll give you a hint. It's not Big Bird.
Spider-Man!
Oh, no. My web shooters are empty.
The Jester throws some marbles on the ground.
Take a trip, Spider-Man! You're slipping!
Spider-Man loses his balance.
You've lost your marbles, Jester. Oh, no. Floored by a bunch of marbles. He's getting away. I better toss my spider tracer.
So Spidey's tracer tags the Jester.
So long, sucker!
Until we meet again, laughing boy.
The Jester has split, but...
I'll trail him with my trusty tracer.
Later, at the Jester's penthouse pad...
I'm glad I'm bad. And the fun's just begun. With my trick toys, I'll rob the world.
Meanwhile, Spidey searches the city for the Jester. He looks high and low.
Here in this big city is my one tiny spider tracer. Come on, Tracer, send me a signal. I'm one weary web slinger.
Finally, on top of an apartment building...
My spider sense says the Jester's down here. This must be the place. Suffering spiders...
And here's what Spidey sees and hears when he looks in the Jester's window.
Time to pack it in, toys. We have other cities to rob.
Spidey crashes through the window.
This time, Jester, the joke's on you.
But there are more tricks up the Jester's sleeve.
I'll teach you to toy with me.
A giant jack-in-the-box slams Spidey in the face. Spidey falls out the window.
I'd better break my fall fast.
And with only split seconds to spare, saved by his web shooters.
Wow, what a close call.
He climbs up the wall again.
This is my comeback, Spider fans.
Spider-Man, not again.
Here's web in your eyes.
Spidey traps the Jester in a web.
The loot's all here. I'll leave this jail bait for the police. I gotta see a man about a reward.
Back at the Daily Bugle.
The Jester's in the bag, JJ. That'll be $24, please.
I don't believe it, you costume crook.
Hey, JJ, Spider-Man caught the Jester.
Okay. Here's my check made out to Spider-Man.
Smile, JJ. You're on the electric company.
Later, at the bank.
This money goes right to Aunt May.
May I see your ID, sir?
Oh, no. I can't reveal my true identity.
Spidey has to tear up his reward check. And so, the Jester has the last laugh after all.
Well,
Like a rooster loves a hen, like a lion loves his den, like Barbie loves Ken, I love to do things that begin with S-N. For example, I love to sneeze.
Achoo.
Pardon me, please.
Achoo.
I like to sniffle, it really feels nice. One handkerchief'll just never suffice. But brother, watch out for the breeze when I sneeze.
Achoo. Achoo. Achoo.
I love to sniff. Just take a whiff. I also like snarling, it feels good to me. Snarling is darling, I'm sure you'll agree. But I'm even happier if I can sniff and sneeze. I love to snore. It's more like a roar. I like to snooze, I like resting my head. I take off my shoes and I snuggle in bed. Sometimes I just lie on the floor and snore and sniff and sneeze.
Achoo, achoo, achoo.
Sometimes I just like to snicker, tee-hee, or snub any snob who is snotty to me. And whenever I have a few moments to spend, I can snoop on a neighbor or snitch on a friend. But much more than any of these, I love to snore and to sniff and to sneeze.
Achoo. Achoo.
Greetings, fellow nerds. I'm Colleen. I'm the editor of Nerd Alert News, and I spend a crazy big part of my day nerding out over sci-fi and pop culture. A big thank you to Captain Phil and Destiny's The Voice of Science Fiction on WUSB Stony Brook for letting me jump on and share some nerdy goodness. Listen to all the programming on WUSB Radio 90.1 FM or stream it at WUSB FM. Trekkies, this is the episode for you. Of course, we must start out by talking about William Shatner's Blue Origin spaceflight last Wednesday, October 13th. Fans across the world wished the Shat good luck and Godspeed as he hopped aboard Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin rocket and went where he certainly had not been before. The 90-year-old set a record for being the oldest person to go into space by climbing 65.8 miles up into actual outer space.
Risk. Risk is our business. That's what the starship was all about. That's why we're aboard her.
He was so moved by the beauty and the adventure that he had that it brought him to tears while he was telling Bezos all about his journey just after landing.
It's the most profound experience I can imagine. I'm so filled with emotion about what just happened. Just, it's extraordinary, extraordinary. I hope I never recover from this. I hope that I can maintain what I feel now. I don't want to lose it. It's so much larger than me and life.
Shatner expressed how the moment was so moving that he hoped he'd never recover from the experience. In a quote by Shatner, and please, I won't even try to sound like him, but here's what he said. It's one thing to say, oh, the sky, it's fragile, and it's all true. But what is unknown until you do it is there's this pure, soft blue. Look at the beauty of that color. And it's so thin, and you're through it in an instant. He also said that the experience showed him how vulnerable the world is, and he affirmed that we need to protect it. Yes, Captain Kirk, we do. He has seen how our planet's atmosphere is so thin. Our planet is so fragile, and it was good to hear our captain talk about it. By the way, did you get to watch it? Thankfully, the place I work at had it up on the TV, and many of us watched in childhood wonder as our very own Captain Kirk went into outer space for real.
Scotty, beam me up.
Now let's continue trekking through this spot with a reveal of Star Trek Discovery's trailer for Season 4. The series is enjoying some well-deserved success with Sonequa Martin-Green at the helm. Time has sure flown by, as we are now in its fourth season, and this year audiences will find Captain Burnham and the crew of the USS Discovery facing a threat unlike they've ever encountered. With Federation and non-Federation worlds alike feeling the impact, they must confront the unknown and work together to ensure a hopeful future for all. Season 4 of Star Trek Discovery will premiere on Thursday, November 18th, exclusively for Paramount Plus subscribers.
And there is a very fine line between a pendulum and a wrecking ball.
Ready when you are, Captain.
Let's fly.
Ready for some much-needed humor during these crazy times? Star Trek Lower Decks delivers just that. Developed by Emmy Award winner Mike McMahon of Rick and Morty fame, Season 2 of Star Trek Lower Decks is proving to be bigger, funnier, and Star Trekkier than ever before. Fans can expect strange new and familiar aliens to challenge the crews of the USS Cerritos and the USS Titan. For Mariner, Tendi, Rutherford, and Boimler, the animated adventure is just beginning.
What do you want, Jennifer?
Ugh, what are you doing?
Cardio, plus a little strength training.
So you work out by staging Cardassian prison breaks.
Yeah, what do you do?
Yoga.
Wow, how unique.
Whatever. Captain wants you in her ready room.
Look, I know we're not supposed to have interpersonal conflict, but I really hate that Andorian. All right, here we go. Computer, resume program.
More Star Trek, you say? Well, my pleasure.
Make it so.
What have you heard about the newest Trek chapter, Star Trek Prodigy?
I've seen my share of wayward crews, and I can tell you this. You've got potential.
A teaser trailer was recently posted, and it looks like a fun way to turn audiences, young audiences yet, into Trekkies. The animated Nickelodeon series was developed by Emmy Award winners Kevin and Dan Hageman of Trollhunters, and it is the first of the Star Trek series franchise aimed at younger audiences. It will follow a motley crew of young aliens who must figure out how to work together while navigating a greater galaxy in search of a better future. These six young outcasts know nothing about the ship they've commandeered, but over this course of their adventures together, they will each be introduced to Starfleet and the ideals it represents. In case you haven't noticed, Paramount Plus is the streaming service for Trekkies. Seriously, they have all the Treks.
How are you, gentlemen? All your base are belong to us. Ha ha ha.
Well, that's all I have for today. Stay tuned for another episode of Nerd Alert News on Destiny's The Voice of Science Fiction next month. Until then, dive into more nerdy content at nerdalertnews.net, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Nerd Alert News. We even have a cool new YouTube channel. So until then, stay safe and stay nerdy.
You will obey. It is the word of Landru.
Thank you so much for joining me for Poetry Corner, brought to you by Rory Kelly and Monday Night Muses. The theme of tonight's broadcast is What Would a Cat Do? And I am going to read you a poem that I think my friend Captain Phil will truly appreciate, because it is a poem straight out of the Star Trek Next Generation series. And I really don't know who owns the intellectual property rights. I am covering this poem as a fan, and I am truly, truly hoping that it's okay. So this poem is Data's ode to Spot. If you have ever seen Star Trek The Next Generation, you know Data is an android who has a pet cat named Spot. And he wrote a poem called Ode to Spot. And I have to tell you, I friggin' love this poem. And there was a whole thing where he has a conversation with Geordi later on the episode. And Geordi's like, you know, I don't know, Data, it's not all about rhyme and meter, you know, like it didn't really evoke an emotion. And I'm like, the heck with you, Geordi. It evoked an emotion in me. I felt feelings. So this is Data's Ode to Spot from Star Trek. Felis catus is your taxonomic nomenclature. An endothermic quadruped, carnivorous by nature. Your visual, olfactory, and auditory senses contribute to your hunting skills and natural defenses. I find myself intrigued by your subvocal oscillations, a singular development of cat communications that obviates your basic hedonistic predilection for a rhythmic stroking of your fur to demonstrate affection. A tail is quite essential for your acrobatic talents. You would not be so agile if you lacked its counterbalance. And when not being utilized to aid in locomotion, it often serves to illustrate the state of your emotion. Oh, Spot, the complex levels of behavior you display connote a fairly well-developed cognitive array. And though you are not sentient, Spot, and do not comprehend, I nonetheless consider you a true and valued friend. That was Ode to Spot by Data, an android character on Star Trek The Next Generation. I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
I'm a very quiet hound. I don't bark or run around. I just lie here on the ground with my head upon this mound. No one knows where I can be found. If they knew, then they'd be bound to come and take me to the pound. That's why I don't dare make a sound.
From the remains of Tom Lehrer and the Electric Company, that was OU the Hound Song. After Spider-Man, we heard SN Snore, Sniff, and Sneeze. Later, Tom will sing one of his best-remembered Electric Company songs, LY. But now we'll open the Destiny's archives for Dune Part 1, Battle for the Known Universe, an audio adaptation of the 1984 Dune film, in the second act of tonight's Destiny's Radio Theater double feature on WUSB Stony Brook.
Now, if you are ready, we will start Dune Part 1. Battle for the Known Universe. In the far reaches of the known universe lies the planet Dune. Its surface is one vast desert. Only on Dune is a spice produced that is so important, powerful rulers fight over who shall control it. That spice, called Mélange, gives people the power to see into the future and to control travel through space and time. Far across the galaxy from Dune lies the planet Caladan. For many years, its ruling family, the Atreides, had been at war with the evil Harkonnen family from the planet Yeti Prime. Inside the training room of the Castle Caladan, young Paul Atreides, son of Duke Leto Atreides, prepared for combat. Today, he was to practice once again with a new secret weapon. With him were three of his father's closest advisors, Dr. Yue, Gurney Halleck, and Thufir Hawat. Thufir asked the boy,
"Are you ready to continue your training?"
"I am ready,"
Paul answered. Gurney Halleck, the weapons expert, ordered the guards to start the fighter robot. Then he turned to Paul.
"Tomorrow we go to Dune. You must be prepared. Dune is dangerous, and so are our enemies, the Harkonnen."
Dr. Yue placed a special collar around Paul's neck. At the front was a box, the new secret weapon, a wielding module. Hanging from the ceiling before him was a fighter robot. It started spinning, its sharp knives and spines whirring with deadly menace. Paul circled the robot with caution, leaping back as it tried to cut him to pieces. Then, suddenly, Paul charged it, shouting. The weirding module on his neck amplified his yell into a terrible roar that caused parts of the robot to burst into flames.
"Perfect,"
Gurney whispered to Dr. Yue. The physician nodded.
"Paul is special. The best student we have ever taught.
He will need every skill he has learned when he gets to Dune,"
Thufir added. Life in the galaxy had evolved in many strange ways. One of the strangest was the third stage navigator, a gigantic, flesh-toned grasshopper-like creature who floated in a glass tank filled with orange spice gas. The navigator had evolved from a human being over thousands of years. He was smarter than most humans, but he was also very dangerous because he could read men's thoughts. The navigator had come to a secret meeting with Emperor Shaddam IV, the cruel ruler of the known universe. Speaking through a translator machine that changed his thoughts into words, the navigator told Shaddam,
"I know of your scheme to defeat the Atreides. You have ordered Duke Leto Atreides and his family to Dune to take over the spice mining. The Harkonnen will pretend to give up and leave, but then return and destroy the Atreides. It is a clever scheme. But if you want our support, you must kill the Duke's son, Paul."
Meanwhile, on Caladan, Paul was waking from a tortured sleep, filled with dreams of Dune. Two women were standing in his doorway, his mother, the elegant Lady Jessica, and an old woman with metal teeth and a shaved head covered by a long black headdress. The old woman whispered to his mother,
"You were ordered to give birth to a daughter to be our future leader, but you disobeyed and had a son. Our ancient religious order of Bene Gesserit women have used the spice melange to look into the future and alter history. You should not have changed that."
As Paul sat up, his mother explained,
"Paul, this is the Reverend Mother Mohayim."
"You are my mother's Bene Gesserit teacher?"
Paul asked the woman. The Reverend Mother nodded, then ordered,
"Come here."
"Come here."
She used the voice, a Bene Gesserit power that forced the listener to follow her commands.
"Put your hand inside this box."
"What's in it?"
"Pain."
Paul pulled back his hand.
"Put your hand inside."
Paul obeyed, grimacing as the pain grew worse. But he did not pull his hand away.
"Enough,"
said the Reverend Mother. Paul removed his hand and stared at it in amazement.
"Why, there's not even a mark on it."
"You have passed the test of courage. Perhaps you will be the first Messiah foretold by our Bene Gesserit prophecies."
Light years from Caladan was the planet Yeti Prime. Most of the surface of that dark and deadly place was covered with a sea of oil. Harkonnen cities floated on that black ooze in huge steel boxes, hundreds of stories tall. Inside his green-tiled chambers, the evil Baron Harkonnen floated freely in the air. He was so fat, he wore special anti-gravity suspenders that kept his swollen body afloat, so he no longer had to walk anywhere. The Baron was overjoyed as he boasted of his plans to destroy the Atreides on Dune.
I have forced one of the Duke's most trusted advisors to betray him. My plan cannot fail.
At that moment, Paul looked out the window of his family's spaceship as it lifted off the surface of Caladan. With it were over 4,000 Atreides spaceships, all headed toward the Guild Highliner, a cargo ship so huge that all the Atreides ships would only be part of its cargo.
I will miss Caladan,
Paul thought sadly.
I fear that dangerous times are ahead.
Once the Highliner was loaded, the third stage navigator took control. He entered a huge map of the galaxy and, with the strange power of the spice melange, he folded space. He changed the position of the planets so that Dune was now below them and Caladan was light years away. Paul felt his heart beat faster as the Atreides ships left the Highliner and headed down toward the sandy surface of Dune. As Paul and his family arrived at Arrakeen Palace, their new home, they were greeted by crowds of happy people.
See how they cheer for us and our soldiers, Father,
Paul said.
Not for us,
explained Duke Leto.
They cheer because the cruel Harkonnen rulers are gone. We must prove ourselves better rulers before they cheer for us.
When Paul reached his bedroom, all he could think about was sleep after that long day. As he approached the bed, a poisoned hunter-seeker dart floated silently out of the headboard. Paul stopped in his tracks, knowing that the dart headed toward any movement and attacked. Paul said quietly,
if I move, I'm dead. I must not move until I can grab the hunter-seeker and destroy it.
Just then, the door opened and Shadout Mapes, a Fremen housekeeper, entered. The dart streaked past Paul toward her. Paul lunged at it, grabbed it, and smashed it against the wall next to the door. Shadout approached Paul and shakily whispered,
I would be dead if not for you, my lord. I must repay the debt by telling you that there is a traitor in your house.
The following morning, Paul and his father flew from the palace in an ornithopter to inspect the spice mining operations in the deep desert.
Will we see any sandworms?
Asked Paul.
Of course,
the ornithopter pilot answered.
The worms defend the spice, and they do not give it up willingly.
Look!
Shouted Paul, pointing.
See how the sand ripples!
A worm is coming. I'll radio for a carry-all to come and lift the harvester and his workers to safety.
But as long moments passed, and the sandworm grew nearer, the rescue craft failed to arrive.
The Baron must have sabotaged my transmission,
shouted the Duke.
We must rescue the workers ourselves.
The ornithopter dropped close to the sand, and the workers ran from the harvester and jumped on board just as the sandworm surfaced. It opened its gigantic mouth and, with its huge teeth glistening, swallowed the entire harvester. Later, safely back at the palace, the Duke walked through the corridors, checking security and talking to his men. In one darkened hallway, he suddenly came upon the moaning, half-conscious form of a Fremen servant on the floor. It was Shadout Mapes. She had been stabbed. Duke Leto kneeled beside her and asked,
who did this?
But before she could answer, she died. At that moment, the Duke heard the engines of the palace's shield generator slow down, then stop.
The generator? The force field that protects the palace has been sabotaged,
he cried out. As he brought his arm up to activate his own body shield, a drugged dart struck him, sending him sprawling to the floor, paralyzed. Leaning against the wall, unable to move, the The Duke saw Dr. Yue standing over him.
So, you're the traitor,
he gasped.
You, my friend, my physician. Why?
Because Baron Hakkonen forced me to,
Dr. Yue answered.
My wife is his prisoner, so I am forced to do his bidding. But we can both revenge ourselves, my lord, and at least save your wife and son.
How?
Dr. Yue held out a poisoned tooth.
With this, put it in your mouth. And when the Baron leans close to you to enjoy his triumph, bite down on the tooth. A poison gas will be released, killing you both.
The Duke nodded, and Dr. Yue placed the tooth in his mouth. Yue then took the family ring from the Duke's finger.
For the new Duke,
he said.
For your son, Paul.
By now, the Harkonnen ships were on the ground, and the soldiers were inside the palace. Soon, the palace was in flames. The Duke lay down and could not prevent Baron Harkonnen from taking Paul and Lady Jessica captive.
Take them into the desert,
hissed one of the Baron's evil assistants.
The sandworms will make sure their bodies are never found.
The ornithopter carrying the prisoners streaked over the vast wasteland of the dune desert. Lady Jessica had been gagged, so she would not be able to use a Bene Gesserit skill, the voice, to order either of the guards to release them. But Lady Jessica had been teaching Paul her skill, and he decided the time had come for him to try it.
Release my mother's gas!
The voice's strength filled the spacecraft. The guard untied the gag, then attacked and killed the ornithopter pilot.
Untie my son!
Lady Jessica ordered. The guard did as he was told. Paul immediately overpowered him, then attempted to gain control of the thopter. Despite his efforts, the ornithopter crash-landed in the deep desert of Dune. Before leaving the ship, Paul pulled the survival box out from under a seat. When he discovered Dr. Yue's belongings inside, he understood.
So, Dr. Yue is the traitor. He shall pay for it.
Then Paul found his father's ring and suspected the worst.
We must get out of here.
Tears filled Lady Jessica's eyes, for she knew that her husband was dead, that he would never see the unborn child she was carrying. Back in the palace, the glow of the flames flickered across the Baron's evil face as he leaned over the body of the dying Duke.
So, my arch enemy now lies helpless at my feet. You shall die soon, Duke Leto Atreides.
The Baron looked over at the shame-ridden face of Dr. Yue.
And you traitor, you shall join your wife in death.
The shame on Yue's face turned to shock as he felt a knife being driven deep between his shoulder blades by the Baron's evil assistant. Turning back to Leto and leaning close, the Baron snarled.
I want your ducal signet ring so I can rule your people. Where is it?
Come closer and I will tell you,
gasped the Duke.
I can't make out what he is mumbling,
complained the Baron to his assistant.
See if you can.
As the assistant leaned over, the Duke bit down on the poisoned tooth, killing them both instantly. The Duke's revenge has missed its mark. This time. The moment that Duke Leto Atreides took his last breath, his wife and son were preparing to run for their lives across the desert. They knew that the sounds of their footsteps would bring the dreaded sandworms. As his mother wept, Paul took his father's ring and slipped it on his finger. With tears streaming down his cheeks, he cried,
Father! Father! I am Duke now. Am I ready for it? Am I ready for it?
But there was no answer. Only the echo of his voice in the cold desert night. Paul and his mother had escaped with their lives from the clutches of the evil Baron Harkonnen. Would the vast desert lead them to safety? Or did the gigantic sandworms have another fate in store for them? Read and hear the further adventures on Dune in Part 2. Attack of the Giant Sandworms.
You're wearing your squeaky shoes, and right there taking a snooze is a tiger. So how do you walk on by? Silently, silently, silent, L-Y. You're a secret agent man who's after the secret plan. How do you act so they don't know you're a spy? Normal, L-Y. At an eating contest, you boast that you can eat the most. How do you down your 50th piece of pie? Eagerly, L-Y. On the lake, your boat upset, and your clothes got soaking wet. How do you stand and wait for them to dry? Patiently, L-Y. In the public library, you fall and hurt your knee, but the sign says quiet please, so how can you cry?
Quietly, L-Y.
As you walk along the street, a porcupine you meet. How do you shake his hand when he says hi? Carefully, L-Y. You enter a very dark room, and sitting there in the gloom is Dracula. Now how do you say goodbye? Immediately, L-Y. Bye-bye.
That was Tom Lehrer with L-Y from The Electric Company. The only other Electric Company song Tom recorded was Silent E, which we spotlighted back when he appeared on Destiny's in 2000. Now retired from both performing and teaching, Tom Lehrer is 93 and living in California. Other surviving members of the Electric Company cast include Morgan Freeman, who narrated the story you heard, Skip Hinnant, who played the Jester, Danny Segrin, TV's first live-action Spider-Man, Judy Graubart, Rita Moreno, Bill Cosby, Mel Brooks, Hattie Winston, and June Angela, the only member of the Short Circus singing group to stay with the show from the pilot to the finale. Jim Boyd, who played Spider-Man on the album, died in 2013 at the age of 79, and Luis Avalos, who voiced J. Jonah Jameson, passed away at age 67 in 2014. In the background is My Road Leads Into the Desert from Hans Zimmer's Dune score. Hopefully, the new Dune, which opened in theaters yesterday, will be successful, and we'll bring you Dune Part 2, Attack of the Giant Sandworms, in conjunction with the sequel. Next week, the Voice of Science Fiction will offer its 39th annual Halloween special, featuring The Shadow in Phantom Fingerprints, as originally aired on October 29, 1939, on the Destiny's Radio Theater. On November 5th, Ken Deep returns for a live preview of this year's L.I. Who convention, which will be held on November 20th and 21st at the Holiday Inn Long Island Islip Airport East in Holtzville, and will feature past Destiny's guests Michael Troughton and John Peel. And in 3 weeks, we'll be live again as the Destiny's film review team assembles to discuss Eternals. As Destiny's 30s continue, listen for sporadic installments of The Flip Side, more poems by Christina M. Rao, new letters to Dear Cthulhu, interviews with Patrick Thomas, Jim Shooter, Jackson Bostwick, and Dr. Mego, Destiny's Radio Theater Adventures of Ghostbusters and Spider-Man, reviews of Ghostbusters Afterlife and Spider-Man No Way Home, Worm Quartet in Concert at Icon 30, a holiday tribute to Edward Asner, panels from Icon, L-Icon, and Ace Comic-Con, and a memorial for Oscar-winning composer and lyricist Leslie Bricusse, who died on October 19th at the age of 90. Among his best-known songs within our genres were Goldfinger, You Only Live Twice, Pure Imagination, Can You Read My Mind, and all the lyrics for the musical Jekyll and Hyde. To offer your comments about our program or to request copies of this or any previous broadcasts, you can write to Destinies, care of WUSB Radio, Second Floor West Side Dining, Stony Brook University, Stony Brook, New York, 11794. You can also send email to destiniesvoice@AOL.com. That's destiniesvoice@AOL.com or tweet us at Destinies. Destinies is produced by members and friends of the Science Fiction Forum in association with WUSB Stony Brook. The forum is located in rooms LO608 and LO609 in the Stony Brook Student Union and holds meetings on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. For information about forum activities, including their discussion of the Rocky Horror Show on October 25th and their Halloween costume celebration on October 27th, go to sf4m.org. That's sf4m.org. To hear archived Destiny shows, including our August 28th, 1992 episode featuring three adventures of the Amazing Spider-Man, visit www.captphilonline.com. That's CaptphilOnline.com. While you're online, keep up on the latest nerd news by nerds at nerdalertnews.net. That's nerdalertnews.net. Learn more about Rory Kelly at rorykelly.com. That's RoryKelly.com. And listen for 3 hours of encore broadcasts and music on the Destiny's Archives Mini Marathon, Thursday, October 28th from 3 to 6 a.m. here on WUSB. Until next Friday at 11:30 p.m. when we'll bring you our 39th annual Halloween special. For Colleen Bement and Rory Kelly, this is Howard Margolin reminding you to stay tuned for a Destiny's Archives Mini Marathon featuring Dune and Spider-Man, saying thanks as always to Captain Phil Merkel and wishing him and you the best of all possible destinies. Good evening and welcome to Destinies. I'm Howard Margolin, and tonight the voice of science fiction salutes the release of Dune Part 2 with the Destinies Radio Theater presentation of Dune Part 2 Attack of the Giant Sandworms, based on the 1984 film version of Dune. Christina M. Rau reads her Wonder Woman-inspired poem, Woman on a Loop. In addition, we'll shine the Destinies soundtrack spotlight on Graham Revel's score for the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries Frank Herbert's Dune, beginning with the main theme.
Woman on a Loop, based on Dara Birnbaum's technological transformation, Wonder Woman, 1978-80. Explosive fire billows, an alarm screams. Diana Prince appears, smart, silk blouse, plastic work ID clipped to belt, tailored brown slacks, ponytail tight, arms outspread, blue eyes wide, black clutch in hand. She stands next to what could be a factory up on a hill of boulders. And she spins. A bright white glowing circle blasts out. This occurs a few times in succession, exactly the same. Then, it's not the same. Diana of Themyscira appears where Ms. Prince stood. A gold crown holds back a brunette mane. A bodysuit emblazoned gold, red on top, blue below. The boots show when she takes off through trees. The blaring alarm shifts to a 70s groove. She settles in the shade of the grove. She spins, and she spins, and she spins. And she's in a hall of mirrors. She pulls off a cuff, drags it along a reflective glass wall. She's wearing all black, hair held back. It's Diana Prince. She spins, and she spins. She's Diana. She's Wonder Woman. She's Diana. She's Wonder Woman. She's Diana. She's Wonder Woman. Back to the bright bodysuit and boots. Through a looking glass, she's in an office hallway and runs into Dale. Then they're in a garage, and there's gunfire, and she reflects all the bullets with quick forearm flicks in succession. Outside again, she runs across a dry field, and she spins. And she spins into the shady grove under trees, another explosion, or the same one as before, and another or the same, and another or the same, exploding, alarming, immediately cut to blue screen, white letter scroll. I am Wonder, Wonder Woman, drumbeat background 70s syncopation, shake thy wonder maker, crooning woman, fade to black.
From the soundtrack of Frank Herbert's Dune, that was Worm Bark, performed by the City of Prague Philharmonic Orchestra and Chorus. In Dune Part 1, Battle for the Known Universe, Emperor Shaddam IV assigned House Atreides to leave planet Caladan and take over spice mining operations on the desert planet Dune. But shortly after arriving, the Atreides were betrayed, and the Harkonnens, operating with the approval of the Emperor, took control of Arrakeen Palace, killed Duke Leto Atreides, and sent his son Paul and Paul's Bene Gesserit mother Jessica into the desert. Now the story continues with Dune Part 2, Attack of the Giant Sandworms.
This is Dune. Now, if you are ready,
we will start Dune, Part 2, Attack of the Giant Sandworms. It seemed to Paul and Lady Jessica that things could get no worse on the planet Dune. Duke Leto, his father, and her husband had been killed by the evil Baron Harkonnen. And now, mother and son were stranded in the desert, wandering toward safety or toward death. As they looked out over the sand, Paul pointed to a rocky cliff in the distance.
"We'll be safe up there,"
he said.
"But if we journey over the dunes, the sandworms will surely devour us."
Part of their survival gear included a thumper, a machine which beat on the sand and drew the attention of the sandworms. Paul set the thumper in motion behind them, and he and his mother hurried away from it over the slippery sand. They had gone only partway toward the cliff when they heard the hissing of a sandworm. The sand began to shake under their feet. Moments later, the thumper stopped.
"Run, mother!"
shouted Paul as a hill of moving sand chased them.
"Run, or we're doomed!"
With only seconds to spare, Paul and Jessica reached the rocky cliffs just as the huge worm burst through the sand and began swallowing the rocks below them. The gigantic worm continued to smash its head against the cliff, desperately trying to reach Paul and Jessica before they climbed to safety on the higher cliffs. Just as they reached a high bluff and safety, a bolt of lightning lit up the cliff, exposing a large band of Fremen, Dune's people. The Fremen studied Paul and Jessica, trying to decide if they would be useful to them. Finally, Stilgar, the leader, spoke.
"The boy goes with us, but the woman will use too much water in the desert. She must die."
With that, he drew his knife and turned on Lady Jessica.
"Stop!"
Jessica commanded. The voice froze Stilgar in his tracks.
"Leave them alone,"
he ordered.
"She's a Bene Gesserit. Her power will kill me."
Chani, a lovely Fremen girl, approached Paul.
"What are you called?"
she asked.
"Paul is the name my father gave me."
"You must have a Fremen name as well. We shall call you Paul Muad'Dib."
Stilgar and the Fremen led Paul and Jessica across the desert, traveling a night and a day, until they reached Sich Tabar, their hidden underground fortress. Climbing down the deep, dark steps, they finally came to a huge black lake.
"This is only one of thousands of lakes we possess on Dune,"
explained Stilgar.
"Soon, all this precious water will transform our desert world into a paradise."
Weeks passed. Paul and Jessica were becoming more comfortable in the Fremen world. The Fremen, in turn, were beginning to look upon Paul as their new leader, the one their legend predicted would come from another world to lead them against the cruel Harkonnen. Standing on a rock ledge in the Fremen Hall of Rites, Paul spoke to the assembled thousands of Fremen.
"We must destroy the Harkonnen and make Dune ours again. To do this, we must control the Spice Melange. The Baron and the Emperor himself need the spice and will have to come to us for it. We will be ready for them when they do."
"How, Muad'Dib?"
asked Stilgar.
"We will need special weapons to fight such evil."
"I have such a weapon."
Paul held up a weirding module, the special voice box which he had used on Caladan and which he had rebuilt for the Fremen.
"We will build more of these. I will teach you to use them. Then we will be prepared."
"How does it work?"
Paul chose a Fremen from the crowd and pointed to a nearby pillar.
"Yell at that rock,"
he commanded.
"Ah!"
The man yelled, but nothing happened. The other Fremen laughed. Then Paul placed the weirding module on his neck, turned toward the rock, and shouted,
"Juk-sak!"
The stone burst into a thousand pieces with sudden explosive force.
"We must act until no evil Harkonnen are left,"
Paul cried out.
"I will lead you, and we will become a vast army, ready to take back our world of Dune."
Months passed, during which the Fremen armies kept up their attacks. During this time, Paul's eyes had turned completely blue, like the Fremen's, from Dune spice, mélange. Then one day, Jessica gave birth to a baby girl, Alia, who was born with all her mother's Bene Gesserit knowledge and skills. Although Paul was now accepted as the Fremen leader, one test remained as final proof, a test of courage and skill. He had to rise.